The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events Office, and I'm so excited to be here to introduce David Troyer. There's a Dakota proverb I like that says, "We will be known forever by the tracks we leave." But history is a tricky subject, as I think we all know, and I think often it's been proven that the victors who write the history can have an agenda. If only there was a writer to give us a more accurate narrative of the last 100 some odd years of Native American history. An Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota and an unromantic chronicler of Native American culture, David Troyer is the author of the novels Prudence, Little, The Hiawatha, and the translation of Dr. Apples. He earned a PhD in anthropology and is a professor of literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California, a Pushcart Prize winner, and a Guggenheim Fellowship recipient. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Esquire, the Washington Post, among other periodicals. Tonight, Mr. Troyer presents The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. Combining history, reportage, and memoir, it offers an epic counter-narrative to the conventional histories of Native American life from the 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee to present. According to Vanity Fair, it, quote, presents a more nuanced and hopeful vision of the past and future of Native Americans, end quote, by illustrating the resourcefulness, reinvention, and reinvigoration of a people, while deftly maneuvering around the pitfalls, stereotypes, and myths some previous histories have fallen victim to. And it's an entertaining read. The Washington Post says that Troyer is an easy companion, thoughtful, provocative, and challenging. And I think we who listened to the radio this morning with Marty Moscoyne found that to be absolutely true. Here to tell us more, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming David Troyer to the Free Library.
Thank you all for coming out on what I guess is a super warm Philadelphia evening. I heard the flower show is open, and you can feel it, you know, it's flowery weather. Those daffodils are coming up, I can feel it. Thank you so much for coming out. It is a cold night, and our lives are busy and full of many things, and I'm really grateful that you're taking some time to spend this evening with me. So thank you all very much. I would really like to just have as much of a conversation as we can. And so what I would love to do is just to talk a little bit at first about myself and what urged me to write this book, to read a little bit from it, and then to save a lot of time for us to have some kind of back and forth. It's really the best part of all of these kinds of things, is to have a real conversation with strangers with microphones. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to talk a little bit about how I came to the subject, because I have to confess that for most of my life, most of my writing life, I did not have any ambition to be a nonfiction writer. I thought falsely that novels were where it's at. That's what the big kids do. Everything else is charming, but fiction, long fiction, was where the action was. And I was wrong, as I later discovered, but I had no ambition to be a nonfiction writer. I was so happy being a novelist. I was so content spending my days making stuff up and telling these long, elaborate lies, because that's obviously what novels really are. And but a couple things happened to me, and a couple of things happened close to home that caused me to swerve into nonfiction, and then ultimately to this project. So in 2005, there was a school shooting at Red Lake Reservation, just up the road from Leech Lake, where I'm from. And Red Lake, it's the same tribe as my tribe. We have lots of family there, lots of friends, really, really my family and my reservation by extension are really closely tied into the goings-on at Red Lake. And there was a school shooting in 2005. This kid, this disaffected kid, killed his grandfather and his grandfather's girlfriend, took his grandfather's guns. His grandfather was a tribal police officer. He went to the school and opened fire, and 11 people died by the time he was done. At the time, it was the second worst school shooting in American history, second only to Columbine. And I used to work for that school district. I used to work in that school. And my father, who's not Native, who himself was a Holocaust survivor, had been a teacher in that school. My mom had worked there as well, so we had really close connections to it. And I was in New York when I got the news, and my brother called me and told me what happened. And I was far from home, and I was frantic, and I was flipping channels in my friend's apartment, trying to get information. And the more I looked, and the harder I looked, the more upset I got. And so I was fuming at the television, and my friend couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. He says, "What's the problem?" And I said, "The problem is that I'm trying to find out what happened, and I can't find out what happened. I need to know. I really need to know." And he says, "Well, you know, why don't you stop and listen to what they have to say?" I said, "Because they're not saying anything. All of the broadcasts on CBS and NBC and ABC and whatever, Fox, all of them, were saying the same thing. On a poor remote reservation, tragedy strikes again." And I said, and I started yelling at the TV at the same time I was yelling at my friend. I said, "That's not the news. That's just the same old sad story about reservations that they've always told. That's the thing we always hear. That's what we see in the New Yorker when they bother to go to Pine Ridge. That's what we see on 2020 when they bother to go to Pine Ridge. They're always going to Pine Ridge, but they're always telling the same story no matter where they go. And that is that reservations are places of darkness, of sadness, and of loss." I'm like, "That's not the news. That's just the same old sad story. And I want to know what happened." But I couldn't find out. And so I had meetings that week about other projects, and I was talking to an editor, and I was talking about how frustrated I was. I said, "That's not what reservations mean. You know, we don't love these places that we're from because they're awful. That's not why we're committed to them. That's not why we love them. That's not the story of our lives or our communities." And he said, "Well, what is the story?" And I said, "I don't know." But that's not it. There's more to it than that. Reservations aren't merely basins of suffering. And our history isn't only a laundry list of abuse. It's not it. And he said, "Well, you know, I've always wanted to publish a book about reservations and what they are and what they mean and where they're going." And he said, "What Native writers write nonfiction?" And this is the part where I give you all career advice, which is to lie through your teeth. Because I said to him, with a straight face, I said, "Sorry, Morgan, but I'm the only one that really works in nonfiction." Having written no nonfiction, I'd never written nonfiction before. He said, "Well, maybe we should do a book together." I said, "Well, if you insist. And I thought it would be easy. I thought that writing novels was hard and writing nonfiction would be easy, and all I had to do was to go out and learn a few things and talk to a few people, read a few books, and then put the facts together. And I was wrong. I spent some years on the book and I handed it in, and then after a long delay, my editor came back to me and he said, "So, we all read it and we think you should start over." And I said, "Oh, you mean there's some good parts and some parts that need work and I should go back to the drawing board and I should rework some of the sections?" He said, "You're really not listening. That's not what I said. What I said was you need to start over, so you need to throw all this out and start over because we're not going to publish this book." And I was embarrassed and I was shocked and I said, "Don't you know who I am?" And I didn't say that, but I thought that. And but then I was like, "Do I know who I am?" And it's one thing to know the kind of tale you don't want to tell. I knew that much. I didn't want to tell the same old sad story. But I didn't know how to tell the other one. I didn't know what the other one was. I didn't know what it needed to be. Life intruded on that problem and helped me solve it. My grandfather died. He committed suicide. He's 83, veteran of D-Day in the Battle of the Bulge, a guy who dodged thousands of bullets and only to sort of find the one that he fired. And I had to write his eulogy. My grandmother asked me to write his eulogy. And I was hurt that he died. I hurt that he shot himself. And I was mad. I was disappointed. And I had to write a eulogy, and it seemed to me that a eulogy had a double purpose. Because I'd never written a eulogy before either. And so I had to think about what they were for. And I said, well, I thought to myself that a eulogy has two functions. Really, you have to say something true about the deceased so that those of us who are there to honor that person, to remember them, recognize the person laying in that coffin. There's nothing worse than going to a funeral and hearing someone eulogized in terms that bear no resemblance to their life, to the life they lived, to the person they were. Like, Uncle Charlie was a helpful soul. He had a kind word for everyone. And you're thinking to yourself, Uncle Charlie was an asshole. He was our asshole. But you can't say he was nice. So you have to say something that's true, even if it's uncomfortable. And the other thing a eulogy has to do is it has to be of some use to the living, because that's who it's for, ultimately. And so as I was thinking about that, my temptation was to just sink into and live in my feelings of anger and loss and pain, and to think of my grandfather's life as tragic and tragically short. And my grandfather had suffered. He really had. He had a hard life in many ways, and lost many of his children, lost grandchildren, suffered in the war, shot himself in the head. And it would have been so easy to focus on that, but I had to think, well, you know, okay, that's not useful to us. What's useful for those of us who have to carry on? What's going to help us? Not wallowing in that, certainly. And I thought, well, you know, it's not even true of him. He was a difficult man. He was a complicated man. He was a man who had suffered in some ways, but that wasn't the sum of his life. He lived 83 years, and the fraction of the second that the bullet was traveling through his brain is really nothing compared to the 83 years he lived. And then I thought, you know, in those 83 years, he lived 80 of those 83 years in the only place that mattered to him, this little village of Bina on the Leech Lake Reservation. 80 of his 83 years were spent in the only place that mattered to him. That's not bad news. That's not bad luck. That's good fortune. He spent 80 of his 83 years in that village, and he saw the only people he loved in this world every single day of his life, except when he was in the army in Europe shooting Germans. That's not bad luck, that's also good fortune. How many of us are that lucky? How many of us see the people that matter to us every day? He'd look out his window, he would see his brothers and his sister and his cousins and his children, his grandchildren, every single day. That's good news. And so the more I thought about him, the more I thought his life is best understood as a life of surplus, a life of plenty, a life of richness. And then that was sort of the substance of his eulogy. But then that got me thinking about this book I'd failed to write. Perhaps the same thing is required of me in the writing of this book that I couldn't write as was required for the eulogy. I had to write something about reservations that was true, even if it's uncomfortable. And it has to be of some use to us. It has to serve those of us who care about these places. And I thought, too, that reservations were best understood not as places of deficit, just like my grandfather, as communities not where there's less of everything, but maybe where there's more of everything. Maybe more pain, but also more humor. Maybe more crime, but also more law. Maybe more poverty, but also more hustle. So if I could see reservations as places of surplus, surplus pain, surplus humor, surplus poverty, surplus creativity and energy. That was the narrative that I'd been searching for. So I succeeded in writing that book. It was published. My editor was happy. But it was also, for me, like a turning point in my own life. I discovered a way to understand this place that I was from that had eluded me for much of my life. And as I thought about that, I thought that, you know, I should apply that to Native American life more generally, not just reservations and reservation life, but our collective experiences of the past 128 years, because it occurred to me that the common understanding, the common misunderstanding of American Indian life is that it is necessarily tragic and brutal and short. When there's any telling of Native lives and Native stories, it's done with a tragic narrative, almost exclusively. And I was reminded of Dee Brown's famous book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, published in the year of my birth. We were both born, same year. And it is the best-selling book of Native American history ever published. Millions of copies in print. Published in 17 languages, never been out of print. And on the very first page of that book, he says something to the effect of, this book is about the American West, a time of unparalleled greed, and it's well documented. And I'm going to start in 1850 at the beginning of the Plains Wars, and I conclude at the massacre at Wounded Knee Creek in 1890, where, and now I'm quoting, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed, end quote. He goes on the second page to say, so if you happen to travel to a contemporary Indian reservation and see the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, perhaps by reading this book you will understand why. Now I should say that reading that book, and I read that book when I was in college, I read it on the 100th anniversary of the massacre itself, 1990, that when I read it all those years ago, I had really conflicted feelings. On one hand, I felt so grateful that Dee Brown would dedicate his considerable intelligence and passion and empathy to thinking about our lives and our history. That felt really good. And I applaud him still for that. And I'm grateful to him still for that. So I felt lifted up on one hand, and then I felt shoved in my grave with the other, with the premature announcement of our collective death. But his understanding is the common understanding. Our lives are effectively over when the frontier closed in 1890, and the government declared that the West had been finally settled, manifest destiny had been achieved. Telegraph spanned the continent, railroads spanned the continent. It was done. There was an Indian past, and now there was going to be an American future. And that's the common understanding. And it was always an uncomfortable feeling to feel that I was walking around functioning as no more than just some little ghost haunting the American imagination, continually having the same discussion, always having the same conversation in various forms, which went something like, yes, I'm Native, yes, we're still alive, and yes, I know I look like Jason Statham, no, not everyone's as lucky as I am to look like Jason Statham. Yes, we still exist. No, it's not like you think. And I'd always wanted a book to hand people, just because I didn't want to keep having that conversation. I just wanted to say, you know what, read this. You want to know what life is like, you know what we're up to, just read this. But I had no this to hand them, really. And as Toni Morrison says, if there's a book that you want to read and it doesn't exist, it is up to you to write it. And I took her at her word. And so after my first attempts with Res Life came The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, which was trying to provide a follow-up and counter-narrative to Dee Brown's classic. And I was trying to provide a narrative with the opposite thesis, that 1890 was not the end of us. It was maybe a low point. It was certainly one of the lowest points in our history, a point from which we have been moving ever since. There's this tendency, so when we rely on these tragic tellings, there's this tendency to then think of ourselves only as victims of history and not creators of it. And I think that impoverishes our understanding of the history, but it also impoverishes our sense of ourselves and our possible futures. And that, to me, is the deeper concern. I really feel like words shape the world. The ways we tell stories shape the kinds of stories that can be told. The narratives we imagine shape the realities that we inhabit and thus shape the futures that we can create. By thinking of ourselves as powerless, as disenfranchised, as victimized, is to deprive ourselves of the power we've always had. Karl Marx has a great quote in a book of his that nobody reads, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. I'm sure it's on everyone's reading list. Where he says, all men make history, but not always as they please. Not always with tools of their choosing. And it's worth remembering that. Native folk, my community, my people, we haven't always had the luxury, we've rarely, in the last couple hundred years, had the luxury to make history as we please, but we make it nonetheless with the tools at our disposal. And I wanted to capture that in the essence of this book and in this counter-narrative. Because to me, the point was not simply to write a counter-history. To me, that would be a dead document. A counter-history would have other dates, other names, other facts, and only that. A counter-narrative is an entirely different way of thinking. And it felt like that's what was required in this moment. And not just required for Native people, required for America herself. There is this tendency to sort of tune into Native lives only occasionally and only as a kind of liberal community service. Like, hey, you know, took all the land, least I can do is read this book. Feel like you've done your part, move on. To treat Native history as a sideshow to American history. But in this city of origins, Philadelphia, it's important to remember that that's not entirely true. That America has always understood itself in relation to Native people. The country has always made itself in relation to us. We're not a sideshow. And I think you can't really get a measure of this country. You can't take its temperature without thinking about, without knowing about American Indian history. One of the very first revolutionary acts, as we all know, was the dumping of tea in Boston Harbor. And I'm sure we all remember that they didn't just dump tea in the harbor, they dressed up as Mohawk Indians and then dumped tea in the harbor. I'm sure we remember that. All of us. I'm sure we remember that in our new republic, which had yet to really solve the question of federal power versus states power, that the first cases that went to the Supreme Court that really puzzled that out were known as the Marshall Trilogy, dealing with the removal of the five civilized tribes from the southeastern United States, which resulted in the Trail of Tears because Andrew Jackson, after the court ruled in favor of the five civilized tribes, said that's their decision, let's see them enforce it, and marched them to Indian territories anyway. But that was the first test of federal power versus states' rights. I'm sure we all remember that in the 1980s and 1990s, the US Supreme Court heard more cases about federal Indian law than any other genre of law. More than immigration, more than reproductive rights, more than finance. I'm sure we know that. I'm sure that we know that in the years after the Pentagon Papers and after Watergate and after the Vietnam War, as America tried to understand itself anew, at least in the courts, it was doing that in relation to discussions of tribal sovereignty. Right? We know that. America has always understood itself, has always practiced the American experiment in relation to us and often with our lives and on our land, always. you can see America's worst behaviors and expressions of its noblest ideals in relation to us. On the eve of the massacre at Wounded Knee, as troops were building up at Pine Ridge Agency in 1890, as Lakota Sioux were becoming more and more invested in the ghost dance after Sitting Bull had been murdered, things were pretty tense. The former Indian agent for the agency, a guy named Valentine McGillicuddy, was writing letter after letter back to Washington and to anyone who would listen, don't send troops, don't send guns. If you send troops and guns, there will be violence and it's not necessary. If the Jehovah's Witnesses were doing some sort of dance, we wouldn't care. He says as much in one of his letters. He's like, don't do this. It will just end badly. So we had advocates for religious freedom, for the right of the Lakota to live as they pleased, even in that dark time. So you can see America's worst behaviors and the best expression of its ideals, even in something like the massacre at Wounded Knee and the events around it. So that's another thing, at least I hope, that the book accomplishes. It sort of redirects our attention and re-sort of shapes the kinds of narratives we see available to us to tell the story of Native lives, but also to help us in our thinking of our collective American lives. America has always been engaged in a civil war. America's always been at war with itself. What kind of country does it want to be? It's being hashed and refought all the time, and it's being fought right now in our electoral politics. Do we want to be a country where the rights of the individual and a path to riches is privileged, or do we want to be a country that privileges the common good? Do we want to support our most vulnerable citizens, or do we want the government to get out of the way? It's a war. It's always been going. And you can see it very clearly when you start thinking about American Indian history. I'd like to read a little bit from the end of the book, if that's okay with you, and then we can open it up to questions, conversation. So yeah, I'll read just a couple short-ish pages. There were a few skirmishes after Wounded Knee in South Dakota, in Utah, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Minnesota, but most of the famous chiefs by 1890, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Geronimo, Chief Joseph, Red Cloud, Buginagijic, Tecumseh, Blackhawk, Cochise, Quanah Parker, were either dead, imprisoned, or in retirement. At the time of first contact, around 1500 CE, Indian populations in North America had been, according to sober estimates, around 5 million. There were more than 500 distinct tribes spread over the entire continent, from the Florida Keys to the Aleutian Islands. The deserts of the American Southwest hosted some of the most advanced social groups who built cities that still stand today. Oh, and if anyone ever asks you what the longest continually inhabited city in the United States is, Acoma Pueblo, right? 5,000 years of continuous habitation. The deserts of the American Southwest hosted some of the most advanced social groups who built cities that still stand today. At the confluence of the Missouri and the Mississippi, where St. Louis now stands, was a city of more than 20,000. Along the resource-rich eastern seaboard, the coast was populated without break from Florida to Newfoundland. But 400 years of warfare, disease, slavery, and starvation had taken its toll. According to the U.S. Census, there were only 237,000 Indians in the United States in 1900. The story of the land parallels that of the population. The United States comprises 2.4 billion acres. By 1900, Indians controlled only 78 million acres, or about 3%. As we've seen, this outcome wasn't the result of a single regime or episode or factor, and it didn't happen overnight, but Wounded Knee came to stand in for all of it, the final blow. A full stop to a long sentence of pain and dispossession. Wounded Knee had been seen not only as the end of Indian life, but also as the end of a kind of American life. The frontier, Frederick Jackson Turner posited, had made America what it was, but the frontier was closed, and its memory was already being turned into myth in dime novels, westerns, and Wild West shows. Indians were on the way out, moving from a life in the world to a kind of museum existence. The guns were cleaned and put away, and the dirty work of death by administration and display had begun. What would happen to American innovation, to the perfection of democracy, to the American dream itself? But not so fast. As I've tried to show in the preceding pages, Indians lived on as more than ghosts, as more than the relics of a once happy people. We lived on increasingly invested in and changed by, and in turn doing our best to change, the American character. It pains me to think about Wounded Knee. It also pains me for different reasons to read about it in books like Dee Brown's. What hurts is not just that 150 people were cruelly and viciously killed along Wounded Knee Creek in 1890. It is that their sense of life and our sense of their lives died with them. We know next to nothing about them. Who among them was funny? Who kicked his dog? Were they unfaithful or vain or fond of sweets? The tiny, fretful, intricate details are what make us who we are. Those are the things that make us human. And they are lost again and again when we paint over them with the tragedy of the Indian. In this sense, the victims of Wounded Knee died twice, once at the end of a gun and again at the end of a pen. We die, too, in our own minds. And this is perhaps the saddest death of all. We are so used to telling the stories of our lives and those of our tribes as a tragedy, as a necessarily diminishing line. Once we were great, once we ruled everything, and now we rule nothing. Now we are merely ghosts that haunt the American mind, that we deprive ourselves of the very life we yearn for. I cannot shake the belief that the ways in which we tell the story of our reality shapes that reality. The manner of telling makes the world. And I worry that if we tell the story of the past as a tragedy, we consign ourselves to a tragic future. If we insist on raging against our dependency on the United States and on modernity itself, we miss something vital. As much as our past was shaped by the whims and violence of an evolving America, America in turn has been shaped by us. The violence itself was certainly influenced by the shifting frontier of conflict between tribes and settlers. As America emerged from its adolescence in the early 1800s, the questions of how the federal government would work with and against the states it united was thrown into doubt by the Indian removals from the Southeast. The modern Supreme Court were shaped by questions of community and obligation between the government and sovereign Indian nations through the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. At Standing Rock, more recently, the water protectors have reminded us of pressing modern questions that are fundamental not only to Indian struggles, but also to our national identity. What and who is most important? To what degree does and to what degree should the government privilege private property and corporate interests over the public good? That's the conflict that was on display at Standing Rock. And what, after all, is the public? In order to answer these questions, I think we have to find a new way to think. Black Elk famously mourned that a dream died in the snow at Wounded Knee. It is up to us to do the next thing, to dream a new one. Walter Benjamin, the German critic and thinker, wrote, "To articulate the past historically does not mean to recognize it the way it was. It means to seize hold of a memory as it flashes up at a moment of danger. In every era, the attempt must be made anew to wrest tradition away from a conformism that is about to overpower it. Only that historian will have the gift of fanning the spark of hope in the past who is firmly convinced that even the dead will not be safe from the enemy if he wins. Today is that moment of danger. And this book is an attempt to rescue the dead from the enemy by looking beyond Wounded Knee. This book is not about the heart that was buried in the cold ground of South Dakota, but rather about the heart that beats on among the Dakota, to be sure, but also among the Dene, Comanche, Ojibwe, Seminole, Miwok, Blackfeet, and the other tribes around the country. And while Wounded Knee was the last major armed conflict between tribes and the U.S. government, there have been many battles since 1890, battles fought by Indian parents to keep their children, and by the children far away at boarding school to remember and keep their families, and by extension, their tribes close to their hearts. Battles of Indian leaders to defeat allotment and other destructive legislation. Battles of activists to make good on the promises their leaders couldn't or wouldn't honor. Battles of millions of present-day Indians to be Indian and modern at the same time. We are, in a sense, the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of those hundreds who survived Wounded Knee and who did what was necessary to survive at first and then bit by bit to thrive. The how of the telling? shapes the what. How we see the people, their lives, their action, and the meanings that obtain from those lives and actions shape the present and shape the possible future. This book is meant to tell the story of Indian lives and Indian histories in such a way as to render those histories and those lives as something much more, much grander than a catalog of pain. I've tried to catch us not in the act of dying, but rather in the radical act of living. Because at the heart of the political convulsions that now grip the, quote, lovely, trustful, dreamy, enormous country, end quote, we love, lies a human question, a simple one. What kind of country do we want to be? Is this government of ours one that should merely get out of the way so that America can once again be, in Ronald Reagan's words, a place, quote, in which people can still get rich, end quote? Or is our government meant to be the angel, avenging or otherwise, of our better nature? It has always bothered me that the very idea of paying attention to or knowing Indian history is tinged with the soft compassion of the do-gooder, a kind of voluntary public service, like working in an after-school program. But if we treat Indian stories this way, we do more than relegate Indians themselves to history, as mattering only in relation to America's deep and sometimes dark past. We also miss the full measure of the country itself. If you want to know America, if you want to see it for what it was and what it is, you need to look at Indian history and at the Indian present. If you do, if we all do, we will see that all the issues posed at the founding of the country have persisted. How do the rights of the many relate to the rights of the few? What is or should be the furthest extent of federal power? How is the relationship between the government and the individual? How has that relationship evolved? What are the limits of the executive to execute policy, and to what extent does that matter to us as we go about our daily lives? And let me tell you, for the cynical among you who feel that it doesn't matter who is in the presidency, for those of you who said that it doesn't matter if it's Hillary or Trump, for those of you who say it's all rigged, let me tell you that policy matters. Who's in charge matters. When you live at the far end, when you live at the pointy end of policy, let me tell you, it matters. So, John Adams, writing to Thomas Jefferson in 1816, urged him to remember that, quote, power always thinks it has a great soul and vast views beyond the comprehension of the weak. If anything, that's the end of the quote. If anything, the lives of Indians, our struggles to and success in surviving, remind us also that our souls have great power. We need to recall the mute agony of the Indian woman, her name lost to history, who was abducted by Columbus, given to a friend of his, sold, traded, raped, and dumped in the sea. We need to remember the strength and dignity of the Oto chief Medicine Horse, who responded to the federal commissioner trying to take his land in 1873 by saying, "We are not children. We are men. I never thought I would be treated so when I made this treaty." We need to remember the anguish of the native father who received news of his daughter's death at the Flandreau Indian School in 1906. He received a letter which read, "Those that were with her say she did not suffer, but she passed away as one asleep. Lizzie was one of our best girls. I'm very sorry that you could not have seen your daughter alive, for she had grown quite a little and improved since you let her come here with me." End quote. To remember these stories and all the others is to remain humble in power and to be called to tend to the troubled soul of the country. It is to remember that our very lives exist at the far side of policy. It is to remember the good and the bad, the personal and the social, the large and the small. It is not to capture Indians per se, but to capture the details of our lives. We are, for better or worse, the body of our own republic. And we need to listen to it, to that body, to hear beyond the pain and anger and fear, beyond the decrees and policies and the eddying of public sentiments and resentments, beyond the bombast and the rhetoric, the sound, faint at times, stronger at others, of a heartbeat going on. Thank you. So, there are microphones.
How much I can be? My name is Leon Matthews, and I come from Wounded Knee. My land is in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. And my girlfriend, Kelly, she saw your podcast this morning, and she said, should we go? And so I did. And I just want to tell you, you know, as a Lakota man, I am Lakota. This man is brilliant. And you know what? It's so warming to find a man like you that represents our people.
Thank you so much.
The Turtle Island. And my question is, you know what we call Ojibwe?
I've got a suspicion.
It's just a joke. But Lakota, they call us Narasu, the little snake. They called us Narasu, the little snake. And we call them rabbit chokers.
Yep, rabbit chokers. Because they,
you know, there's so much love. And I did read Dee Brown's book.
Yeah.
I'm a writer. And if I could be half as much as you.
Oh, dude. I'm sure you're much more.
No.
I mean.
I want to go to KU. You know, study American Indian Studies.
Wow.
And I want to, like, teach our young people. And I want to be your friend.
Oh, thank you. Niji, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That really moved me. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Recently, a group of Quakers we've been working on right relationship with Indigenous folk. And we have committed to wherever we go, claim that we, most of us, are settlers here on the Lenni Lenape land. So we want to give honor to the land and the inhabitants of that place. And so I just want to say that here, that we are settlers on the Lenni Lenape land.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I should say that it's not really the subject of the book, but my book is infused with this idea. Like, my father is not Native. He's a Jewish Holocaust survivor, and he made it to America, and his parents made it to America, and they largely made it here because of the help of the Quaker community, who helped them resettle in Yellow Springs, Ohio, who found my grandfather work in Iowa. You know, so my family has, on my father's side, it was a great debt to the Quaker community. Thank you.
I'm very glad we braved the elements to come here tonight.
As am I.
I share your father's tradition related to the Holocaust. And my question to you is, coming from both of those traditions, how has one tradition of survival affected, influenced, inspired, whatever, the other tradition of survival? And how do they live within you?
Yeah, there's a burden of blood on both sides of the family fence, you know? And my father passed away the week I started writing this book. I sat down to write this 2 days after his passing. He was 90. He'd had a good life. And we had a good relationship, you know? And so I thought about him a lot as I was writing this. He was the most pessimistic, optimistic man I have ever known. And in the years before he passed, he had Alzheimer's at first, and then he had dementia. And that, for a man who survived by his wits for so long, to lose them was really hard to watch. It was really tough. And toward the end, you know, you get fewer and fewer stories until there's just a few greatest hits that are kind of running, you know? And that's just the nature of the disease. And so I thought I'd heard everything I was going to hear, and we were talking. I don't remember what we were talking about, but I remember I was in a bad mood, and I said, how can you stand this country? I said, I don't have a choice. America is around my tribal homeland, as I understand myself. Like, but you chose to come here. How can you stand what she does? And he looked at me like I was stupid. He was really good at looking at me like I was stupid. It brought me right back to my childhood. Like, what's wrong with you? That's how his look looked for so much of my youth. He looked at me like I was stupid, and he says, well, this country saved my life. No other country saved my life. You know, they all turned me away. But America did not. And he said, so since it saved my life and I made my life here, you know, the debt I owe is to always make it better, is to try and make it better. That's the job. That's always the job. That's the only job, is to make it better. I owe her that, to save her from herself. You know. And he lived that way. And so that kind of optimism, that kind of hope, I think, infused the writing of this book. That collectively, that's the job, you know? And my mom was, she was pretty, is still with us, and is pretty fierce. Cuddly in her own way, but she's a tough woman. You know, she's survived a tough childhood. And someone asked me once, like, how did she overcome a childhood of despair? And I was like, you don't know my mother if you use the word despair in relation to her outlook on life. Life is something that she is going to win. She did this strange, it was something that was very hard to do, being a native woman from a poor village on a poor reservation in the middle of nowhere, where you're trained not to want anything. You're trained not to expect anything from life. And she dared want more for herself, which was very hard for her, someone like her to do. I don't know why she did. She's just wired that way, but she was going to do things. She was going to accomplish things. And so together, like I like to think they, I live out some of their best qualities, and I've left some of their worst qualities behind. You know, time will tell. But they were both complicated inspirations for me. But thank you for your question.
Thank you for speaking to us. I'm a Cherokee hereditary, and I was wondering how we apply your thoughts in your book through the 562 tribes in the United States who have been disaffected for more than just 100 years.
Right.
I'll leave with that.
Right. If I understand your questions, it's like, I hope I understand your question. I was just in Oklahoma, and I try to explain this to people. I end up explaining all of this in relation to questions about Elizabeth Warren a lot. You know, that there is no such thing as Native American life. There are just Native American lives. There's so much diversity, culturally speaking, and also in terms of our historical experiences of colonialism, among other things. There's so much diversity. If you go to someplace like Oklahoma, this is immediately obvious. You'd be in a room of 100 people, and 80 of them have some relationship with nativeness, even if they're not enrolled, even if it's just a family story, like Elizabeth Warren. You know, those stories are so common in a place like Oklahoma. You know, and the history is so complicated too, that I hope the book is expansive and big-hearted in a way that takes into account the fact that there's no such thing as native life. There's just native lives. There's so much diversity, and there's so much strength in it. I hope that answers your question. I'm not sure if it does. So. Thank you.
I'm a mixed blood, too. My father was Oglala, and my mother was from Germany. So my Lakota family very nicely calls me a Lakrauta.
Lakrauta?
Lakrauta.
That's awesome.
Yes.
They called me Running Bernstein.
But I just briefly looked at your section you have about Carlyle. Yeah. I am descended from two students who were in the first class.
Wow. Yeah.
And I, with some relatives and friends, we formed a Carlyle Indian School project. We're working to looking at land and building an interpretive center as a proper monument to our greatest generation.
Oh, I hope you succeed. That's so necessary.
We're working hard at it.
Yeah.
But I appreciated that in your, so much of what I've read, is that you're telling the kids stories, and they don't look like victims. Yeah. And whenever we talk, being so involved in the past 10 years in talking about boarding schools and the impact that it had in Indian country, people have a tendency to make it a tragic, horrible story.
Right.
And the reality, at least at Carlyle, at least what we've been able to, I know that there were tragedies, I know there were horrors, and there were probably more horrors than there were great stories. But it concerns me that our youth, who still, we still have a horrible youth suicide rate. Mm. There's nine people below 15 in my family that have committed suicide.
Wow, I'm so sorry to hear that.
That if we don't tell the other side of it, or say that there was more to it than that. They weren't just victims. There were good stories that came out of it, and
right.
And there was strength of. They had their own kind of strength, and they made it through and became something else on the other side.
Right.
But they were still here.
Right.
The victimization concerns me, and how the kids are programming it in their minds, the constant victimization. So I just wanted to comment about
that. Yeah, thank you. I think you're really right, you know, especially in relation to our children, you know. And I think it's changing in some really interesting ways, although there are, as you point out, there are still a lot of hard things that affect Native people. To abandon the tragic narrative does not mean to ignore the traumas and difficulties that we're faced with individually and collectively. It means to acknowledge them in relation to other things, as you point out. But things are changing a little bit. Like when I was a kid, and when I was a young guy, and I was in college, and you'd meet Native folk you didn't know, there was this game we always played. And it was sort of, you know, we just trade stories from home, but there was an agenda to see if the people you were meeting were legit. And the way we figured out who was legit was based on how hard we'd had it growing up. It's true. To be authentically Native when I was younger was to have suffered. And if you didn't, I mean, were you really Native after all? That was at the heart of it. It was true. And there's all this sort of insider-outsider crap that would go on around hardship. And what I see now, and kids still do that, you know, who are you and what's your deal thing all the time. I mean, that's just how communities work. But now, when I listen in on those kids doing that stuff, it's different than when I was a kid. Now I hear the kids like, hey, did you go ricing this fall? Oh, you don't rice? If you're Ojibwe, right? Wild ricing. Everyone goes ricing. If you don't rice, are you legit? Did you go to ceremony? Like, were you at Standing Rock? There are ways in which they're kind of still playing the same games, because that's just how groups work. But they're doing it around things that are positive. It's changed. Do you speak your language? Do you go to ceremony? Yeah. Things like that. It's really cool. It's not perfect. There's still troubles. But it's changing. And I like it.
I'm curious about how your parents met and got together, and to what extent and in what ways were the issues of their having come from two different cultures navigated? And also with you, did you at a certain point feel you needed to define yourself as this and not that, because obviously you can pass for a Bernstein.
Sure
and
can.
Not all that many Indians can, and that's, to me, very fascinating. Yeah. Essentially, you are able to live in more than one world in this one life, and that's a treasure. So in a way, I'm thinking, gosh, he's kind of all to one side when the mixing, it's like an artist mixing colors. When you mix stuff, magic can come out of it.
Maybe.
That's never been seen.
I like thinking of myself as magic that has never been seen. And I think that's my new name. That's my Philly name. There are lots of native people of all different hues and shapes and looks. And again, like Oklahoma is proof of that. Even my own family, my older brother looks like a Hollywood Indian. He looks like wind in his hair. You know? It's just the luck of the draw. I got lucky. And but so I would say that I'm not alone, you know, in the fact that I don't have the stereotypical phenotype, you know. How my parents met, well, that's a scary story. Don't get the wrong impression. Don't get the wrong impression. But they met when he was her high school English teacher at the high school on the reservation. I told you not to get the wrong impression. That's how they met. And then they re-met some years later when he was no longer teaching, and she was, and they were both working on the same healthcare program under Johnson's War on Poverty, the CAP, Community Action Program, funding on the reservation. They were coworkers. And then they started dating. The only difficulties my parents had were that my dad was a spaz. Not because of his Jewishness. And he describes sort of moving to the reservation, like, I reject the idea that I'm torn or moving in two different worlds, because I don't think there are two different worlds. I think there's one big world, you know? Native communities, native cultures are not these little islands in the American Ocean. You know, we're not just in America, we're of it. It's one big world. So I reject that distinction. But that said, I didn't really feel torn between my father's heritage and my mother's heritage, because the Germans had done a really good job killing my family on my father's side, and I didn't have a big family. I wasn't raised in a Jewish community. I didn't know any other Jewish people, really, other than my father, who even when they were in Austria, the family was completely acculturated. They were socialists. They believed in Marx, not God. And when he met my mom and lived on the reservation, he wanted to be Ojibwe. He felt he was finally in a place that understood him and that he understood. So that I never felt torn for historical reasons, but I always felt proud, and to this day feel proud of the heritage, of course, that I get from my father and the consciousness of his survival and the Jewish people's survival is definitely a part of how I think of myself. I didn't have any traditions. We had weird family traditions, you know? Like I'd go snaring rabbits, as per, and yeah. And then I'd come home, and then I'd have to practice piano, and then my father would be boiling down maple syrup in the kitchen, you know, like quoting Macbeth, quoting the witch's speech from Macbeth. And that was a typical afternoon in my family. And I thought it was weird, and I just wanted a normal family. Of course, everyone wants that when they're a kid.
You seem to be speaking in tandem with a report called Reclaiming Native Truth, that whose purpose is to correct the current wrong narrative and start a new, accurate narrative about Native American experience. You familiar with that at
I'm
all?
Not familiar with that at all.
NativeTruth.com.
Reclaiming Native Truth. I'll definitely check it out. I would just like to say, sort of, in the interest of full disclosure and with no false modesty, This book is the result of my best efforts, but it's certainly not the story. It's my take on it. It's how I see things. It's entirely subjective. And yet, despite being my best effort, it's far from complete. And that I don't speak, and I couldn't speak for certainly not my reservation. I'm not empowered to speak on behalf of my community or for them. I can only describe as things as I see them and describe the, and recreate the past in the book as I see it. And I don't say that with any kind of false humility, but with real humility. And in this book, since it was about Indian life, not Indian death, I went out on the road and I interviewed so many people from so many different communities and tribes, and young and old and educated and not educated, and it was like I was back in school, like I was a kid again, and I got to learn from all of these people. And I was talking to this really old Blackfeet dude named Red Hall in his 80s, this fiddle-playing ex-cowboy. And he's like, well, I'm pretty good after 1934, but I don't know much about that before then. And then he was trying to, like, he's like, I don't know why. And then we were going back and forth, and it was very awkward, and then he finally admitted, he's like, I don't know why you want to talk to me. I don't really know a lot about things. And I said, Red, with all due respect, you do. You are an expert about what life was like as an Indian man in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. What it was like to try to find love. What it was like to find a job. What it was like to live on the high plains and to cut horses, to herd cattle, to load them onto trains. I'm not an expert in those things. You are. And I want to know what life was like for you, how you lived. And so he's like, okay. Then he finally, you know, got it. And we spent all these days together talking. And they're the experts, you know, in my opinion. And I'm just trying to conduct as best I can. So, but I'll check out that thing, though. Thank you so much for drawing my attention to it, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.